when you then left Wellesley and went to Temple, that was in a co-educational school.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was pure on everything. We were absolutely equal. I mean, I suppose there were more men than women in all my classes.
But there were a fair
But there were plenty of women.
Of women,
yeah.
Did you have any... How did you feel about that educational experience and being with men compared
Well, I was
to
very unhappy that I had to... When I was 20, I had one Saturday evening a month to myself. And, you know, you never get to be 20 again. So my life was made up entirely of work and study. And I'd usually do most of my homework on the streetcar going to and from work.
Does that mean that the students at Temple were probably not as affluent as those at Wellesley?
Well, I suppose most of the teachers were not so distinguished as the ones at Wellesley, but it was they had very high standards, and I got exactly the same kind of teaching that I got, and afterwards I had one or two rather distinguished teachers at the University of Pennsylvania. But I can't see if they were any better as teachers.
Now, what kind of job were you were back at the newspaper then while you were going to Temple?
Yes, most of that time. Yes, I think all the time that I was at Temple, I was working on the North American.
Mm-hmm. And you said that none of the
And then I left. Yes, I left them to go up to Boston to live. Like so, most young people, I wanted to get away from home.
So you worked on the paper for about 3 years then?
No, I should say about 4 years. Mm-hmm. But then when I went up to Boston, among any number of different kinds of jobs, I started doing occasional feature stuff for the Boston Post.
As a freelancer, though?
Yeah, I was just... Mm-hmm. And from that time on, I was freelancing all the time, but it was not until about... Well, I suppose 30 years ago at the best that I've been able to earn my living simply by writing.
So you were always doing
Very few writers can. Yeah. I was an insurance claim adjuster for 5 years, for instance, and I've had all kinds of jobs.
But the whole time you were always writing.
I was writing all the time and selling, but not selling enough to live on.
But you didn't go to another newspaper then in Boston?
No, I didn't go on the paper. In fact, I think I made one or two inquiries, but there just weren't any jobs there.
Oh. Now, did you have any sense of the kind of career that you could pursue that would let you write and earn enough
No,
money?
The only thing was to get any kind of job that would pay my living expenses and then write in the time I had left.
I see.
No, but there were no jobs. I mean, I did later on. I was... For instance, I was on the staff of the Associated Advertising, which was the magazine of the organ of the Associated Advertising Clubs of the world. And then later in Baltimore, I edited a house organ for an olive oil company. I suppose that's a vague connection with writing. And for a while in Boston, I did public relations work for two or three organizations. So it's hard to say. I'd always prefer something where I could do some writing. Mm-hmm. But if worse came to worst, I worked for fire hydrant companies and lumber companies and piano company here, so that's just good.
And it was primarily in a clerical sort of
position? I was what they then call a stenographer and now call a secretary. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was a public stenographer in San Diego for a while.
Now, but you didn't see... going into the newspaper field as an alternative to be a writer in
No, I didn't, largely because you may think it peculiar, I was a very shy, timid person. I couldn't, the way I got jobs was having somebody tell me about it and recommend me.
Oh, I see.
I never had the nerve to, as a matter of fact, when I had to go to an interview, I always got violent diarrhea. I simply couldn't face people down. And I was always glad for a job where I could be alone and do my work and not have people around me.
I see. Now, how many women were there working in these places then? They were just beginning to get into those
Oh, yes, by that time, women worked in all the offices.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it was getting close to the time when a man scenario was unusual unless he was a court reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all the jobs, the many, many jobs I had, substitute and permanent, I never saw a man in the office except as a boss. Oh yes, they did. The bookkeepers used to be men, usually.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever involved in that bookkeepers and stenographers union?
I never took bookkeeping. Not with my attitude or arithmetic. All I studied was typewriting and shorthand.
Now, did you become involved in radical politics at this time?
No, I never was until my first marriage.
I see. So you stayed involved?
Until I met the man who was my first husband. I was, in a sense, I suppose you'd say I was always open to that kind of thing. And by that time, I was soapboxing for suffrage around Boston.
Oh, well, tell
in
me
the
about
evening,
that.
We'd stand on the soapbox on the corner. But,
what year was that?
I lived in Boston the second time from 1912 to 1915. And I became the official reporter for the Ford Hall Open Forum, and we had all kinds of speakers, and that's the first time I ever did hear any radical speakers.
I see.
And then we also had what we call a town meeting, in which I was the clerk, and we had it was an imitation of a. A New England town meeting, and people would bring up all kinds of bills, and we would discuss them and all sort of thing. So that I was very receptive, and when I finally met the man whom I married, why, he was a sort of combination of Southern aristocrat and an anarchist. He converted me all the way over very quickly.
Now, was this the suffrage activity was connected with this town hall, or were you in a separate suffrage group?
No, it had nothing to do with town hall, except that I suppose everybody at the town hall meeting, I suppose most of these were the you see, the open forum was a big public thing, hundreds and hundreds of speakers and people, and very well-known speakers always, but the town hall was just made up of regular attendance at Ford Hall. We met in the headquarters.
Mm-hmm. And so you were in a separate suffrage group then?
It was a regular position to be not clerk of the town meeting, but the reporter for it. We got out a weekly, why do you call it, a paper?
Well, a newsletter.
And what I did was take down the speech in shorthand. And then we had all sorts of departments, and I wrote some of them.
I see. Now, what was the suffrage group that you went out soapboxing for?
Well, it was the Massachusetts. I lived in Boston in what was called a home for self-supporting women, in a very bad part of the city, worse even than this. college. What do they call it? Denison House. I forgot. The College Social Settlement was right across the street from us. And we had two old four-story houses thrown into one. And for very small fee, we got a room, or usually with a roommate, but I was always alone, and breakfast and dinner. And the head of it was a lady named Bertha Hazard, who was from the South but had lived for many years in Boston and was a very active suffragist. And it was probably through her that I asked her about what could be done here, and she probably sent me to headquarters, but I don't remember.
Do you remember the name of the group?
Oh, I don't, except that every state and every city had its woman suffrage.
Yes.
It was probably the Woman Suffrage League. Mm-hmm. It was a woman named Maud Parker, I know, who was the head of it, but I know
that name.
It's too long ago.
Now, were many of the girls who were living in this...
No, I think I was the only one that was... Oh, there may have been literally one or two social workers who were more or less... but nearly all the girls were devout Roman Catholics, and their whole interest was in the church.
I see.
Boston, you know, is a highly Irish neighborhood. And
I
was the only one, I'm sure, that took any active part.
And what did the suffrage group have regular meetings then?
I don't remember any meetings they must have had. They got out all kinds of literature, and they had these evening, in those days, every evening in every city. The downtown street corners were all occupied by soapboxes, literally sometimes. Sometimes we just called them that, and they were little platforms with a flag. And later on, when I was speaking there for some of the radical martyrs and victims when the war started, I can remember there'd be a religious meeting at the other side, and I'd get up and yell, you people that are listening to Fellow Worker Jesus, come over and hear something about the real workers' movement.
What kind of experiences did you have when you were soapboxing for suffrage?
Well, we always passed out petitions. There was always some election coming, when we went over them later, we would find all kinds of facetious things like Luke McGluke and that kind of thing, just names put down. But we always got a certain number of actual voters.
Now, how would you go about starting this meeting exactly?
I mean, how would you start it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was usually somebody from the headquarters who would get up and make it an opening talk, same way the men are in the soapbox for socialism all over the Pacific Coast. And whoever it was would introduce the speaker, and you would know you were going to speak that night, and you'd have some kind of subject to talk about besides the general one. And you would talk for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and then you'd ask your questions.
How large a group did you usually have gathering?
It was just people going along the street. I suppose there were people who spent every evening going from one place to another, just like Hyde Park in London.
Now, was it primarily men who would be your observers and listeners?
Well, I don't know.
Were there couples or just men who were your audience?
Oh, you mean in the audience? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they were just the same kind of people you'd find if you had an auto accident on the corner. People who were going behind stopped to listen. If they were interested, they stayed. If they weren't, they left.
You weren't terribly
Some of them
harassed.
Went from one to another just to spend an evening listening to conversation.
Weren't the women harassed because...
I don't remember. No, we never had any actual, that I can remember, any physical violence. Of course, we got jeers and catcalls, and in those days you didn't use four-letter words, so nobody called us 13-letter words or anything like that. But we would we'd be interrupted, of course, and heckled. But that was part of it. You expected that and learned how to handle it.
Were there women soapboxing on other issues or only suffrage?
I don't remember. By the time I was soapboxing for other, there were other women, yes. But in those early days, I don't remember there were any. I think most of the others outside of it weren't suffrage, except for some special issue that might be coming up about housing or something. Most of them were religious. They were missionaries of one kind or another. They were either promoting the Bible or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did they respond to you, the religious people, respond to the suffrage women?
They didn't pay any attention.
Oh. They didn't pay attention.
We all had our own audiences, and of course, we preferred to have a larger audience than anybody else, but you couldn't hold them. If they wanted to go, you had to keep better today.
Now, so each of you would take a turn soapboxing then, is that it?
As I remember, I would say, what evenings do you have free next week or something like that, and make a schedule for the week. And I'd usually speak once or twice a week.
Now, this went on every evening then,
yeah.
Someone spoke?
Yeah. They had volunteers to speak.
Mm-hmm.
A great many people didn't like to speak in public, especially this shifting audience of strangers on the street.
And then did you hand out literature afterwards?
Well, then somebody else from headquarters would be passing things around.
Now, what did you talk only about suffrage, or did you talk about feminism generally?
I think it was mostly about suffrage. Of course, we also talked about the right of a woman to have her own control of her own earnings. You know, those were the days when a married woman who worked, her husband could take all her money, and he decided where they should live, and if they separated, he got the children. So a lot of women stayed in very unhappy marriages because they're going to lose their children. So I suppose we talked about the peripheral subjects, but it was primarily that the way to help women was to give them the vote so that they could be citizens too. As my brother lived from the time he was 21 until he died at 70 in Washington, D.C. And they didn't get the vote till after he was dead. And around election time, when he'd write me, he'd always start his letter, "Dear Citizen." But I never voted until I came to California, because I came to San Diego in 1915, and they didn't have it. California had suffrage, and I voted first in the 1916 election in Los Angeles.
So you stayed in Boston till 1915 then?
My fiancé came to San Diego, and when he got a house and things of that sort, he let me know, and I went out from Boston to San Diego in February 1915.
So you met him in Boston?
I met him in Boston, though he came from Memphis.
And he was involved in some of the anarchist circles?
Well, by that time, most of the radicals in those days, I never knew any socialists until several years later. Mm-hmm. Most of them were anarchists. They were what they call philosophical anarchists. And so most of the people that I met through him were. And he was introduced to me by my, I was a then and secretary to the secretary of a very well-known lecturer, and she became a very good friend of mine, and she met him, I think, there was a rival to Fort Hall called, not the School of Social Science, but something like that, and that was where they did get all kinds of radical ideas, and Mabel used to go to occasionally, and she met him there. And I remember the first time she mentioned, she said, "Did you ever meet that anarchist that gets up and talks at the?" And I said, "No, I don't want to meet him. If you got a normal man for me to meet, I'll be glad to meet him." So that was the beginning of my first marriage.
Now, what was your attitude towards men at this time? Because you had your earlier...
Well, I remember saying to my father when I was down on a holiday or something in Philadelphia when I was living in Boston, thank God I never saw a man in Boston except the janitor. And my father was horrified. He was afraid I was turning into a lesbian. I wasn't. I was simply uninterested.
Did he mention it in
those terms?
Oh,
no, of course not. Good Lord, no. He'd have died if I had said a word like that.
Wasn't it very unusual in those days to even talk about something like that?
I don't remember ever discussing sex with anybody, except to one man before my sister had a baby. My mother was extremely Victorian, very prudish. She never even, I knew from reading the medical books about menstruation and all that kind of thing, but she never mentioned it to me. She once, I think she said once in a shamefaced sort of way when I was obviously developing, "Do you know what's going to happen to you?" And I said, "Oh, certainly." And she said, "Oh, well, that's good," and I don't say anything.
Then as a gynecologist,
she... So then she handed me some bird's eye to ham. They used that instead of Kotex in those days.
What was it?
They called it bird's eye. It was a thick, heavy thing like a diaper. And they all had to be hemmed by hand.
Huh. Now, even as a gynecologist, though, wasn't something she would discuss with her woman patients?
Oh, no, she never discussed that. Well, I suppose she did with her patients. She had to. If she had somebody with cancer of the cervix, she certainly had to tell her so. But at home, in a private lot, she wouldn't think of mentioning anything like that.
Huh.
Now, I can remember once I had a bad habit in my childhood. I couldn't get to sleep at night, and I had a terrible time waking up. That morning was always late. But I used to sneak out. My father would have evening calls, and then he'd come home maybe about 10 or half past. And I had a firm belief in my childhood. The whole world changed at 10 o'clock, and it was a grown-up's world. It was a completely different place, and I was very eager to know what it was like. So I would get out and sit at the top of the stairs where I could hear my father and mother talking downstairs. And I remember once, I can't remember what it was, my father must have told my mother a slightly dirty story, because she laughed a little and said, "Oh, you shouldn't have told me that one."
Now, so up until the time you met your husband, you still didn't have much use for men then?
Well, I just didn't know any. Oh, I did, yes. No, but this was all after I met Austin. I remember that summer we had what they called the Sagamore Sociological Conference on the seashore near Boston. And I was there, of course, it was run by Ford Hall. And I think it lasted about a week. You know, we'd have talks every day and concerts. First time Roland Hayes ever sang in public. And there was a young Unitarian minister whose name I've completely forgotten. It was a three-barreled name, but he was kind of taken with me. And a group of us were at the beach. I can't remember what happened. It was something that we had to get from some house nearby or something, and he went with me to help carry it. And when we got inside the house, he kissed me, and I slapped his face. And he said, "Why'd you do that? That isn't the way to treat a man." And I said, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." And he said, "Why, if I like you?" And I said, "Well, you're a minister." I also remember about that time one of my high school friends married a young doctor, and we were at some kind of gallery, art gallery or museum or something, this young man and I. And I don't know how it came up, but he made some remark that struck me as anti-feminist and made me angry. And I said, "There's no difference between men and women." And he said, "There's a vast difference." And I was so angry I walked out on him. And he followed me down the path like, I mean, he was still saying, "It's perfectly natural, it's perfectly natural." So you see, I was very prudish too. I never in my life used any kind of, talked about anything like that. And my friends and my high school friends never talked about any sexual subject. Mm-hmm. And as I said, most of them weren't interested in anything much except having a good time. And by the time I just didn't know any boys. And in my high school senior dance, I simply hadn't any boy to invite. And my father, I think, bribed a young man in the drugstore that he used to take me. And I was a terrible dancer, so he certainly should have had a bribe. Well, but my brother was 5 years younger, and of course his friends were just children. So I just didn't know any boys. And when I grew up, I didn't know any men. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, I guess I must have been 25 before I knew a man well enough to have him call me by my first name outside of my family.
And that was not until you met your first husband then?
Just about then. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it was through the people I met through him that I got to know any man.
Well,
but then I found out afterwards, and I was so unobservant of such things that two or three of the men in Ford Hall had quite a case on me, and one of them came up and just before I left and wept all over me and all that. So he wished he didn't have such Fabian methods. He had got it in their head. There's nothing I could say except her, but I never even guessed.
you just had no exposure to men. It wasn't that you were really...
I wasn't against them. I just didn't know them. Mm-hmm. But from the time I went got connected with Ford Hall, I didn't meet a lot of men. There was a young man whose name, strange to say, was Jack London, who even one night when we were walking somewhere, I think he was walking me home from Ford Hall, he proposed, and I just laughed at him. And he said, "It isn't funny," very stiffly, and I said, "I didn't think you meant it seriously." I hardly knew the man. I had the slightest interest in marrying.
Now, so what did you think about the possibilities of marriage? Were you were interested in getting married, or you never thought about it?
I went through a sort of semi-depressed state during those years. In fact, I was an outpatient in a on the Peter Bent Brigham Psychiatric Ward for a while. And I think probably it was that I did have at least just a one-sided life. I remember the doctor says, you're lucky that you didn't get one of the Freudians. That was the first time I ever heard of Freud. But from the time I met Thompson and fell in love with him, I never had any more difficulties.
But did you feel pressures that you should be finding a man?
No, I just, I was just unhappy in general about many things. Mm-hmm. I took everything very hard, very emotionally.
Now, all of this time you were actively involved with your writing?
Oh, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. As I say, in those days I wrote much more verse than prose. Mm-hmm. And I was getting a fair reputation.
And what sorts of magazines were you being published in then?
Well, at first just in what they called the special, the little poetry magazines, but after Harriet Monroe started poetry, I appeared in there more than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. As long as she was alive, I was a regular contributor.
And
there was
came
nothing
out of Chicago,
one in after that.
That was published in Chicago, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I got to know Harriet Monroe very well. In fact, I visited her in Chicago when I lived there. I lived there for a while. And I saw her just before she went down to South America and died.
So you kept writing, and at the same time you held these various clerical
jobs. I wrote stories and I wrote articles. And as I got new interests, I got better acquainted with the periodicals that dealt with them. Mm. I mean, for years I wrote regularly for the Nation and the New Republic. And that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I had stories in both the Masses and the New Masses and the Liberator. In other words, about whatever I was doing, mm-hmm. I wrote about.
And at the same time, though, you were supporting yourself through these clerical jobs, for instance, in Boston.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I should say so.
And you really viewed that just as your livelihood, not with any great interest. Your main interest was writing.
No, I was just, the only thing I was interested in was becoming known as a writer. And the other thing was just to pay the rent.
I see.
Buy clothes.
Now, tell me how you met your first husband then.
Well, as I say, Mabel talked to me about him, and then at that time, I was doing public relations where she had an apartment with a big room that she didn't use. So I had it as an office. I rented it. And I was working late one evening when he came to have dinner with her. And so, in spite of the fact that I said I didn't want to meet him, I couldn't very well get out of it. Oh, I think she came in before he arrived and said he was coming. And I said, I'd hurry my work and get out. And I said I had a headache. I don't believe I had. But then he came, and I couldn't very well just walk out. And as soon as we were introduced, he asked me to join him for dinner. And Mabel said very quickly, you have a headache, haven't you? And I said, oh, it's gone. We talked all evening, and he walked home with me. And from that time on, we were
together. And what
did
he do?
What did he do? He came from a wealthy family. He always had some kind of income, and he was writing a great philosophical book that was still being written when he died in 1948. So, in the early days of the movies, both in Hollywood and in San Diego, he played bit parts in the movies, and he'd had all kinds of. His father owned the biggest newspaper in Memphis, and he'd done some work on that.
Oh. And when you met him in Boston, what was he doing?
He wasn't doing anything that I can remember. He was just living. As I know now, he was carrying on four or five different affairs. That was the understanding, that monogamy was unnatural. And the theory was that it applied to both of us. But every time a man got interested in me or him, I was entirely too fine a person to be having anything to do with that man. So the consequence was that I remained monogamous. And he not only slept with every woman I've ever known him to know, but he brought them home, and it got rather on my nerves. That was the final end of our marriage.
Well, when you married, did you have this agreement about it being a non-monogamous relationship?
Well, the way he proposed marriage was, he said, I'll either marry you and not support you, or support you and not marry you. Which would you rather have? And I said, I'd always rather support myself, so let's get married. So we did.
But you knew it would not be a monogamous relationship?
Well, if I didn't know it, I must have been very stupid, because it was every woman he knew in Boston that had something to do with it.
Now, were you...
I was his third wife, as far as that goes, legally.
So you had planned that you were going to continue working, and the marriage was just...
I was working all the time. As I say, I was a public stenographer in San Diego, and we lived in Coronado, across the bay. And then in Los Angeles, where we went up the next year and rented our house in Coronado, that's another job I had forgotten. I was a secretary to two lawyers, and then I got a job as on the house organ of a big oil company. I forgot what they call it, Pan Pacific American or something. It was Doheny's. And I was secretary to a retired Church of Ireland minister, Anglican, who was in charge of one of the departments, and among other things, edited the house organ. And in the end, I did most of the house organ.
Well, when you married him, then what was your own attitude towards marriage and having a family? Did you?
Well, no, it was never any question. From the very beginning, I had been very anti-baby. And it was understood that I would have no children.
Was it related to your feminist beliefs? Or?
I think so, yes. The children interfered with your work, for one thing.
And this was true.
I've never liked children. I've never liked babies or anything like that. I feel very embarrassed when I have to say something nice about a baby. Of course, I learned a very nice phrase. You say, well, that is a baby, and they're very much pleased. Well, I know I can remember very well when my brother was born. I was 5 years old. I hated him. I was very jealous of him. I never was jealous of my sister. We quarreled a good deal. But just the thought of this, and it was obvious that they made a great fuss about him because he was a boy. Actually, I think now they made a great fuss about him because he was always in very poor health.
Mm-hmm.
And all his life he was a semi-invalid, though he was married and had children.
Do you remember thinking that it was because he was a boy that they
had
the fuss?
Yes. I'll tell you, they talk about penis envy. The first time I saw Alan naked, my mother stood him on the toilet when she was toilet training him. And I saw this thing hanging down from him, and I was terribly embarrassed. I was afraid I had a deformed brother, and I was so afraid people would find out that my brother was deformed.
Oh,
and it wasn't until a good deal later that I found out that every little boy was deformed. But I was so accustomed to his being ill most of the time. He had polio when he was 9, he was paralyzed for a year, and he was always had something wrong with him. So that I just took it for granted this was another of the things that was wrong with him.
Was it because, in fact, your parents... favored the idea of having a boy that you think you felt that?
I don't, well, I imagine that in my mother's family and her brothers and sisters, that they were pleased. I can remember my aunts coming when Alan was born, and I was 5, as I say, but I could already read and spell fairly well. And I can remember my aunt coming and calling to her mother, Fanny, it's a B-O-Y, and I said, I know what that is, that's boy, and I've got a brother. And I wasn't at all pleased about it.
Well,
I'd rather have another.
At the time of your marriage, then, you were relatively prudish still.
I was what?
Relatively prudish still. You have very Victorian attitude
yourself.
Oh,
well, then. Not nearly so much as my mother, but in general, yes. When I was in kindergarten, when I was first sent to kindergarten, this very tough neighborhood I lived in, except for an unfortunate little boy who was a doctor's son, and his name was Skull, which was bad enough, and his mother dressed him in little Lord Fauntleroy costumes, and all these tough little kids, and every day poor Willie would go home rags, and his mother would fix him up with velvet and lace and a long blonde curls, but except for Willie, I think I was the only person there who wasn't one of the shipyard workers' children.
Oh, I see.
And there were some very, very really bad little boys. The boys especially, I don't... My first friend I ever had was a little girl whom I adored, and it was Laura. And she wore a plush coat that I would go up in kindergarten and just touch it. And then when I was out one day with my aunt, and I found Laura and her mother, and they were carrying a big basket of wash between them. Laura's mother was a grandmother. And the first note of snobbery I ever heard was when my aunt said, "You mean that's Laura?" I was going, all I talked about at home was Laura. But the little boys were very, very bad. And it was the worst of the lot was a little boy named Billy, a group of sycophants that followed after him. And I never fought back. So I was the butt of all of Willie's.
Oh, they beat up the girl?
They were all boys. But he picked on me. The other girls would fight back, but I wouldn't. And the kindergarten had just an ordinary rough, not even cement, just ground with a wooden fence all around. And Billy would come out and bang my head against the fence just to show off to the boys how easily he could do that. And then he'd say, "I won't bang your head anymore if you let me show the boys your flannel petticoat." So I let him show the boys my flannel petticoat. Then one day, Billy came up to me and he said, I want to show the boys how to fuck. Well, I'd never heard the word before. I had the most idea what it meant. But if Billy recommended it, it was something I didn't want. So I said no. And he banged my head hard and said, "Come on." So he dragged me to the boys' toilet, and all his little group gathered around. And he said, "Now take off your drawers." And I said, "I can't. My mother does it for me. I can't do it." So he got one of his little followers to do it, at which moment the teacher, Mrs., came out. And I don't know what happened to Billy. Maybe he was just expelled. I was sent home to my mother with a note, and I wasn't sent back to kindergarten until next year when my little sister, who was a born fighter, would be there to protect me. And you know, the reason I tell this story is that subconsciously, all through my childhood, that thing haunted me, and I felt it was an awful disgrace. I decided I'd been raped. Until I had an English friend visiting me, oh, I guess that must have been 30 years later, or 30 years anyway, and I told her this story, and she laughed and said, "I was raped by a grown man, and I was sad." So from that time on, it never bothered me.
Huh. But all those years you
thought... Well, those years, I had a subconscious feeling that I had been raped in childhood.
But I wonder if that didn't account for a lot of your attitudes.
I think it did. Uh-huh. I think it had. That's why I told the story,
yes.
Not because I think it's a nice story.
Yes. Hmm. Now, so when you married, it was a very romantic sort of affair that you'd had with this young man.
Yes, and I suppose you would call me a demi-virgin when I was married. We didn't live together, but he and some other people rented a place out in the country, and I'd go out and spend every weekend with him.
Mm-hmm.
And as I know now, he was an extremely practiced seducer, but it was all completely new to me, and I was very much in love. And he was with me, except that he got tired of any one woman for too long. So very gradually, we never actually had intercourse before we married, but it's about as near to it as you could get.
And then he introduced you to anarchist ideas then?
Well, then he went out to, he was gone 7 months in California and left me in Boston.
After you were married?
No, that was before. And then I went out and I couldn't tell any of my family that I was going to be married until it was too late for them to do anything. My father had put a detective on us when he'd heard rumors. And when I went down to visit home, he regaled me with a lot of scandal about it, and I already knew.
What was his objection?
Well, he had a good many objections, mostly the fact that he was very obviously a Don Juan, and he was 15 years older than I was, and he'd been married twice and divorced twice, and he had no particular means of support that anybody could see. In other words, he was the most undesirable son-in-law. So I didn't let any of my family know. I told them I had a good job in San Diego, and I stopped by in Philadelphia and said goodbye to them, but I didn't say a word until we actually married. And Monson met me at the station.
Now, what was his name?
Collier, Monson Collier.
What was the first name?
A-O-N-I-S-T-A-D. Oh. Pronounced in Memphis, Onston. He preferred to be known as John Adam, but I never would call him that. I wrote a play which was produced here in 1924 about him, in which the hero or the protagonist is called Francis Kenyon for the same reason John for the saint in me and Adam for the primal man. He's a very persuasive person, the most beautiful southern accent you ever heard.
And was he actually affiliated with other anarchists?
With other what?
With other anarchists, or was he just very much an individualist?
Well, the point of anarchism is that you don't associate. You're all individualists. You don't believe in government.
Yes,
any kind of associate.
Associated with people like Emma Goldman and Alexander.
No,
Bergman.
Well, to this extent that I once held a hall for all day against the police until Emma and Sasha
was?
Could come and speak. But everybody we knew all these people. And a woman doctor, in Los Angeles, for instance, whose name I've forgotten, but she was an anarchist. And another woman doctor I knew in Boston who was an anarchist. And you know, all the people you'd meet in a circle would be some kind of either anarchist or later on they would be members of the IWW.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't socialists. Mm-hmm. They were very scornful of the political parties.
So this was really the beginning.
None of them ever voted or anything like mm-hmm. that.
This was really the beginning of your political involvement.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, well.
Perhaps if I'd met instead somebody who was far to the right, I'd have been McCarthyite. I don't know. I doubt it.
I doubt it. I think it'd be difficult as a feminist.
But I was always very open-minded on this, and I'm never horrified or shocked as my parents were by my associations.
But this period, when you got married then, actually did begin a whole new period of
in
your
a
life,
sense, yes.
It?
Oh, yes, very much so.
And was that the end of your suffrage activities?
No, it wasn't, except that when was the amendment passed? 19.
It was ratified in 1920, but California had the vote in 1911.
Well, of course, after that, there was no need of doing anything.
But once you came to California.
I never was active in politics, I mean, party politics or anything like that. Oh, I have many times addressed envelopes and that kind of thing at various headquarters, but that's about all.
But the suffrage activity stopped primarily because once you came to California, suffrage was already a fact here, and there was
no you see, here it was, I think we'd already ratified it, even. So by that time, we didn't get into the war in 1917, you know.
But during the earlier free speech fights and the early wobbly free speech fights,
well,
were you in California?
I was, yes. Well, you see, I was with, from 1920 on, I was with the Federal Radio Press, so I was covering everything, every phase of radical activity. But we'll
you
go
came
on
to
all
California
that later.
In 1916, yeah. Then? You came to California.